repulsion towards another electron, and can even throw out the electron from the free radical, from the atom that is trying to give a donation to. Ouch! Because both of them are going to repel before they join, and the energy level between the two electrons on that free radical would be the same in different speeds.
Azuru?
Yes, Rich.
Just in response to what Paul said, are they going to come up with tests that tell you you have too much of this stuff in you? I don't know if this is germane at all, but I had a blood test that came back and said I had too much potassium. And my doctor looked at me and says, don't eat so many bananas. And I said, I don't eat that many bananas. But that was the first time in my life of 70 years that I've ever had that come up on a blood test. And if you have time, Roy, I'd like to make a comment about the higher math you were talking about, or a question, but a simple question from a simple mind.
Okay, Rich. As far as the potassium, doctors all the time, there's machines in the old days, they called them smack sixes, where it gave you the electrolytes and such. So almost everyone tests everyone else's potassium. That's a very simple, very easy test. We know a lot about it. Sometimes it's because people are taking diuretics that remove sodium and hold on to potassium. But unfortunately, occasionally, if you take a blood sample and you shake it too hard, because there's a lot of potassium in red blood cells, if you rupture them, you will get a false high potassium level. That's a very common thing. So those types of tests are much simpler than testing for antioxidants, which are a range of different molecules and would require a ridiculously large amount of laboratory work to accomplish, and you don't even still know how much is in the cell. You just try and infer it by the serum concentration, and those things are usually sucked up by cells anyway. So it probably would not be terribly effective. It's probably just easier and better to tell people to behave better, like that's worked in the past. So that's my comment about that. Going back to Wesley. No, the fact of the matter is that there's no electrorepulsion. The free radical is positively charged. So if you give it a free electron, it will take it up and it'll calm down and stay quiet. It's the ripping electrons away from other molecules which is the cause for oxidizing agents for these things to cause their problem. And not that they don't want an electron. They want an electron from somewhere, so this is sort of a sacrificial electron in an antioxidant. Does that answer your question, Wesley? Are you there, Wesley? Okay, perhaps he'll come back soon. Rich, you wanted to ask something about hyper-complex numbers, I guess.
Yes, for those of us who know nothing about higher math and math, not math, I'm from Queens. I was wondering, the issues you were addressing when talking about the higher math as you were talking about, what are some common day occurrences or products or whatever that would affect my life because people are working at that level of mathematics? I mean, you know, I could think of space, of course, but because I don't know, and chemistry, but is that level of mathematics used on a daily basis to affect somebody like my life?
Well, Rich, if you're talking about complex numbers, simple complex numbers, I mean, every time you plug in your VNA/antenna analyzer, the numbers it's giving you are complex numbers. When it says that it's 50 ohms plus 32J, that's giving you the real resistance and the reactance as an imaginary number. So, you know, from electrical engineering, it's incredibly important, complex numbers. You pretty much can't do much without it. As far as the higher ones, the quaternions, as I said, actually are used in computers a lot. So you might have a cell phone that's able to tell what orientation it is, how it's being rotated by the accelerometers and all the other little sensors, but it's plugging in all those numbers into mathematics that's using quaternions as a way of detecting and realizing where you're moving the cell phone in three-dimensional space. So it's happening under the hood. No one's bothering you to study quaternions, but they are practical, and they're used in a lot of equipment that we take for granted.
You say a majority of that type of mathematics is being used in the millions of types of electronic devices in this world?
Again, it depends what we're talking about. If we're talking about complex numbers and such, it's all over radio electronics. Wherever you have the concept of impedance is inherently a complex number. It is not a real number. It is a combination of a real number and an imaginary number. It's a two-dimensional number, if you will. If you're talking again about quaternions, quaternions are seen a lot in computers because quaternions can be done, can be worked on through computers much more easily than our brains let us do it. So a lot of software that especially manipulates objects in three-dimensional space tend to use the underlying mathematics of quaternions rather than the matrix math that electrical engineers are taught and have been taught since the 1800s because Haverside lost his contest with the other guys of how to explain all these things in terms of vectors. So they're doing matrix math, but computers are doing quaternions.
The matrix math are used highly in CGI stuff?
I don't know. I assume at some point early it was mostly matrix math, but I would assume by now they're doing a lot more using transformations, using quaternions, simply because the mathematical symbol manipulation in modern-day computers is much better suited for that. But I'm sure the original CGI, when it was rather primitive, just used the same old matrix math that engineers had been using for 100 years.
How about television?
Excuse me, someone was saying, how about television?
Yes, color TV, high-definition TV, all involve very high...
Okay, I don't know if it really manipulates three-dimensional math much. It requires other things. There are all kinds of incredible functions, cosines, and discrete cosine functions that reduce the redundancy of signals and compress the data stream to a much, much tighter, smaller amount. But I'm not quite sure if it really does much in terms of three-dimensional rotations that quaternions would be particularly good at.
Yeah, but I think you brought it up, Roy. I don't think that was a question.
Okay, so what is the question?
As I heard it, where do we need high math in today's life?
Okay, it depends on your definition of high math and in our life. There's a lot of things going on in the background that most of us don't have the faintest clue of what's going on. There's a lot of high math. There's a lot of complicated math that goes on every microsecond in the average computer that we're blissfully unaware of. So if the question is generally about high math, yeah, it's all over the place. I was just addressing with Rich the question of the complex and hyper-complex numbers that I was talking about earlier.
All right, fine. WB2EAV, back to listen.
is it possible to understand the information that VNR gives you without understanding the subtleties of the high mass?
Think so. I mean, you don't really have to know the nitty gritty of it. You could, for all intents and purposes, all that you would probably require is the absolute impedance. You may not even want to know the phase angle. It's important in some circumstances, but there are a lot of times where it's not terribly important for the average person. So, and you don't have to understand that you're dealing with an imaginary number, or that it's a right angle on an axis, or that the multiplication is a rotating in a two-dimensional field. You know, all those things are nice and fun to read about if you're interested in mathematics, but the practical approach is, if you know how to solve Pythagorean's theorem, you know, the square of the legs of a hypotenuse equals the legs of a right triangle equal the square of the hypotenuse, you can pretty much get anything that you want, and it doesn't really require you to bother your mind about imaginary numbers and such.
Well, that answers my question. Thanks, Rick.
Okay, very well. Rich, I just wanted to kind of give a little bit of texture and history behind the things that we sort of take for granted. I mean, you pretty much have to know a complex number in order to pass the Hand's license these days. So I thought it might be entertaining for people to kind of experience complex numbers history, and that there are even higher dimensional versions of hyper complex numbers out there working in the background while we quietly just enjoy ourselves.
Don't get me wrong, I'm fascinated by the subject. I just like listening to the jargon, even though I don't understand it. I love listening to it. I always have. The fact, you know, that I don't need it really to really understand how antennas work, I could get away with what you said I could get away with, which is about the level of my ability. That's reassuring. And in computers, other than three-dimensional movement, I could only see this being applied to the manufacture of the chips. What else does it apply to?
Well, I mean, I have to fall back to computers again, because it's anything that does a lot of calculations based on rotation of an object in three-dimensional space. So if you have an industrial robot that moves things around, most likely its brains are using quaternions. If you're doing 3D animation on a computer, it's doing quaternions. Your cell phone, and if you're asking it whether it's horizontal or vertical, or whether you're rotating it right or left, those are quaternions. So it's more of a computer-type hardware-software thing where it calls for the need for being able to keep track of rotations in three-dimensional space. There are versions of that that go back to electrical engineering again, which back in the old days they just decided to designate as matrix math and do it that way, as opposed to the quaternions. But primarily quaternions are best suited for some form of three-dimensional transformation.
I asked you about holography. For some reason, holography hasn't taken off to be the most incredible, you know, Star Trekian thing that it was supposed to be, or ubiquitous as it was supposed to be. Is this math highly involved with holography?
No, I don't think so. Holography is basically based on interference patterns. You develop an image in some way that produces interference patterns that we see as different views at different angles, like a three-dimensional object. It's kind of difficult. You need somewhat expensive equipment to really pull it off. It has to be a very, very stable device, because any shake or something is going to ruin it, and usually you need a coherent light source, which means it's monochromatic. or you need three different holograms that have to be matched up that are made from three primary color lasers. It's just kind of a mess. People are working on it. They've been working on it again, you know, like most things, for 40, 50 years. And there are some very nice little things that they have, but they don't have any big things, and they're not full color, or there are little gotchas. It's kind of like the video telephone. The technology hasn't kind of got up to the point where it's worth the trouble. But there's a lot of holography out there. You can buy little pendants and such where there's a holographic image imprinted in it. And I think they're even trying it for anti-counterfeiting measures. So it's being used in very limited amounts. There are other things that aren't quite holography, where you see a rotating blade, and the blade is lit up in different ways as it rotates around in a circle, giving you an image of something, you know, hovering in space. It's not really a holography, although they brand it as something like that. But there's a lot of work on it, but it's not ready for prime time in any kind of shape that anyone would pay a lot of money for.
Definitely in the terms of space, this mathematics, because, you know, it's all about things in dimensions, I don't know how to put this, because this is how stupid I am. But is this higher math the type of which you're talking about, the main type of math studied in spatial and objects in space?
No, it's not necessarily part of the outer space, you know, type of astronomy or such. It's more just three-dimensional space. So it could be the space here on Earth. It could be the space out there. If you were, say, rendering a computer-generated 3D image in a hologram, you would probably use something like quaternion to help with the rendering of a three-dimensional object. So it's more just generally, it doesn't have to be inner space, outer space, sideways space. If it's any kind of rotation of an object in three dimensions, quaternions are helpful. If it's not rotating a three-dimensional object, it's probably not terribly helpful.
Yes, thanks a lot, Roy, for taking the time. W2BZ.
No problem, Rich. Anyone else with any comments or questions before I move on? Okay, scientists in Japan reported seeing two radioactive weather phenomena at the same time for the first time, according to a new paper. The observation establishes a link between two, adding to our knowledge of the wild physics that takes place inside thunderstorms. The researchers reported the unequivocal simultaneous detection of a minute-long gamma-ray glow followed by a powerful millisecond terrestrial gamma-ray flash. Though scientists have observed these two events before, they don't quite understand the connection between them. The glows and the flashes have never been observed together, that is, until now. The main result is that we, for the first time, confirmed the relation between gamma-ray glow and terrestrial gamma-ray flashes, said Yuki Wada, the study's first author and a PhD student at the University of Tokyo. The Gamma Ray Observation of Winter Thunderclouds collaboration is a group of scientists with radiation detectors who monitor winter thunderstorms near the Sea of Japan. These storms are unique for their low-altitude clouds, making them good targets to study. The detectors are special crystals the size of thin bricks that flash when struck with high-energy particles. Photomultiplier tubes amplify the flash into a signal readable by data acquisition systems. During a storm on the evening of January 9, 2018, one of the growth detectors began to record an increase in radiation for 60 seconds, the sign of a gamma-ray glow. A nearby detector started measuring the glow as the signal waned in the first detector. The glow in the second detector suddenly spiked and then stopped. The first detector, too, measured a quick jump in gamma rays, which lasted around 2/10 of a second, the terrestrial gamma-ray flash. Lightning struck between the detectors, allowing the researchers to take data on both processes simultaneously, according to the paper published in Communications Physics. Having two detectors let the scientists know approximately where the glow came from. Let me drop for a second. Scientists have been aware of high-energy physics occurring inside thunderstorms since the 1980s, when gamma-ray satellites started to measure terrestrial gamma-ray flashes blasting into space. But they didn't really know why so few lightning bolts came with these flashes. Meanwhile, gamma-ray glows have been observed in the air, at sea level, and on mountaintops, and are generally associated with passing thunderstorms. In case you're worried, the radiation from the glow isn't harmful and has only a fraction of the dose you'd get from a medical x-ray. As for the lightning, well, you don't really want to get struck by lightning. Other researchers have previously theorized that a mechanism called relativistic runaway electron avalanches creates the environment for the glow and the flashes. The storm's strong electrical field accelerates electrons to high energies, producing more high-energy electrons. The gamma rays come from these high-energy electrons interacting with the nuclei in the atmosphere. But when and why the flash occurs has been up for debate. Perhaps it's due to the electric field in the lightning bolt, or maybe it's just something a little weirder called relativistic feedback model, where the electric field is strong enough that it sets up a runaway chain reaction, producing the antimatter counterpart to electrons, as well as a lot of more electrons to undergo the gamma ray producing interaction. Let me drop for a sec.
Here I have a problem with nucleus. What nucleus and where they come from, and what electrons, where they come from.
Okay, Wes, well, let me just get to the end of it, and then we can talk. Anyway, the last paragraph. The growth data seems to match what would be expected from a relativistic feedback model. Whatever caused this surge in the glow appears to be a rare process, since there have been a lot of glows observed in Japan without it, and we have been desperately needing a rare process in the clouds that we can associate with terrestrial gamma-ray flashes. Since one of the biggest mysteries of terrestrial gamma-ray flashes is why such a small fraction of lightning produces them. Okay, that's the story. Let me drop for a second, and then we'll get back and talk about where these electrons are coming from. So the idea is you're setting up an electrical potential from a cloud that has a large charge differential. This causes ionization of the atmosphere in the region locally, causing electrons to shoot right down the ionized path at very high speeds, at near relativistic speeds. Eventually, when it gets close to its endpoint, there's a lot of atmospheric gas. They all have nuclei, and occasionally one of those near relativistic electrons bang smack dab into a nucleus, and you might have a positron, you might have gamma rays. That's the theory.
So in other words, you say that the electron has enough energy to be swallowed by a nucleus.
No, I'm not saying it's swallowed. I'm saying it's banging right really hard on it, and all that kinetic energy is going to translate into some kind of interaction. Sometimes contact just generates a high-energy gamma ray. In other cases, it might do a lot more confusing stuff with the local protons, and so I guess theoretically you can say it fell into it, but not quite. It's just you're taking an object, you're speeding it up ridiculously high, and you're banging it against something else, and when you take a particle and give it a lot of energy, it can convert into all kinds of interesting things as long as some of its quantities are conserved.
Well, the problem is that in electron capture, an orbital electron is captured by nucleus and absorbed in this reaction. So all of those modes decay represent changes of one in the atomic Z, the apparent nucleus, but not change in the mass number. So we may see alpha decay in different in this situation, because both atomic and mass number of the apparent nucleus decrease, but I don't see the reason for gamma ray just by energy interaction without affecting nucleus.
Yeah, Gamma ray is electromagnetic energy. Electromagnetic energy can be converted from kinetic energy, and that's pretty much what's going on. You're changing, you're taking the momentum of a near relativistic electron and bashing it across something, and if you have to have conservation of energy. So eventually you bang it up against the nucleus, you're left with an electron that's going a lot slower now. You got to figure out where the energy went, and the energy went in electromagnetism, and the energy was great enough to produce something in the gamma ray range.
What kind of energy can trigger electromagnetic a wave at the frequency or the wavelength of gamma? It is unclear to me, so if you don't mind to explain the example of such interaction.
Wesley, I mean, ultimately, that's how X-ray machines work. You raise a potential difference across a field. You get a thermal emission of electrons. The high voltage difference accelerates the electrons. It smacks the other surface, and the energy that it gives off in electromagnetic waves is high enough to be in the X-ray range. X-ray range and gamma ray range are pretty much the same range. The only thing, as I told you before, for the most part, if you're not an astronomer, that defines the difference between X-rays and gamma rays is the source. If the source of it is from an electron, usually we say it's an X-ray. If the source is from a nuclear decay, we say it's a gamma ray. But they could be the same frequency. So it's the same as an X-ray emitting a tube. It's just going on out there in lightning bolts.
Gamma rays are typically more energetic than X-rays, so they have more ionizing power compared to X-rays. And gamma rays are used to stellarize equipment, not the X-rays. They also cure cancers that they use in radiotherapy. So I have never seen any X-ray machine that is producing gammas. You have hard X-rays and you have a soft X-rays. And below that, we have ultraviolet. But the X-ray machine to produce gamma, I didn't hear about that. I'm sorry, and to exchange.
Again, Wesley, it's a matter of semantics. There is no particular frequency that's called X-ray, you know, goes to hard X-ray, and then at one more cycle, it goes to gamma ray. Gamma rays and X-rays can be the exact same frequency. They're both high-energy electromagnetic waves. We've seen more higher-energy gamma than X-rays because, as I said before, X-rays are produced by electrons being accelerated. So that's why usually we call them X-ray, which is why gamma ray emitters are radioactive decay, and they use accelerators to produce radioactive material. The radioactive material decays, and we call that gamma ray radiation. The X-rays accelerate an electron across a voltage potential. We call those X-rays. But they can be the same frequency. There is nothing in the literature that says that they can't. It's simply the source of the photon, of the electromagnetism, that determines whether it's truly an X-ray or a gamma ray, unless you're in outer space, in which, since they didn't know really what was causing it up first, they decided on a rough approximation of this particular band is X-ray, that particular band is gamma. But as long as you stay away from astronomers, gamma rays and X-rays can be the same frequency.
I must research that because I have a hard time to agree. X-ray photons have energies in range of 100 electron volts. But gamma rays goes greater than 100 electron volts. So when we're talking about cesium-137, is 662 kilo-electron volts, and cobalt is 2.5 mega-electron volts. And that energy level says about the frequency. So when you're saying that we have exactly the same frequency, exactly the same energy level, which actually both exclude each other, that I have a hard time to swallow it and to exceed it.
Okay, well, what can I tell you, Wesley? This is the nature of the definition of these things. If you look historically, I'll take a look through the websites. I'll find you a couple of nice documented cases where it's the origin that defines them, not the energy level, unless you're talking astronomically. Once you're talking astronomically, they fudge it. But as long as you say on this planet, there is no definitive frequency or energy level that discerns the difference between X-rays and gamma rays. But I'll look and I'll find some source material. I'll send it to you.
I do thank you very much for that. I believe we should classify it by means of ionizing radiation. So when we talk about 100 electron volts, which is actually corresponding to very particular frequency or wavelength, and not any other, then it has less ionizing radiation than anything that is over 100 kiloelectron volts, and the higher is the potential in electron volts, the higher is ionizing radiation. That's why I have a hard time to understand. I can say I might be wrong, but I just didn't go across that. And to achieve.
Well, Wesley, I would have a problem with the concept of more or less ionizing radiation. Once you get to ultraviolet electromagnetic waves, they ionize atoms. So ionizing radiation starts in the ultraviolet area and just continues. So both X-rays and all gamma rays, to one degree or another, are ionizing. They all have more energy than an ultraviolet-colored electromagnetic wave. So they're all ionizing. Their energy level is sufficient to knock a valence electron out of its shell.
Yeah, I found something. I believe it's on your favor. Gamma and X-rays are on higher frequency and of electromagnetic spectrum. Some would argue that gamma is a higher frequency than those higher energy than X-rays, but this is not necessarily true. There is much overlap between them. As mentioned in other answers, one difference is where rays originate. Yes, actually, that is exactly what you're saying. A nucleus in an excited state has extra energy, may release energy via gamma emission. Electrons transitioning into the lower atomic orbital may emit X-rays. Electrons propagating through a material may be accelerated, slowed down by the electric field of a nucleus and will emit an X-ray. Bottom line, gammas come from the nucleus, X-rays come from electrons. So that's the distinction.
Okay, Wesley, so basically it's what I said. X-rays are generated by electrons at being accelerated at different voltage potentials, and gamma rays are due to radioactive decay using the weak force.
So now, coming back to your unhappy electron that is striking with high energy, the nucleus, you don't have X-rays. You have only gammas. And to exceed.
Again, we got a problem with semantics. The basis of calling it gamma ray emissions is based on astronomical satellites that found it. So when an astronomical satellite finds high energy electromagnetic waves, they tend to report them as gamma rays. Probably, strictly speaking, unless there's some kind of interesting interaction going on with the nucleus other than simple collision, it's probably more accurate to call them X-rays. But again, it's a very blurry line these days, and people interchange them all the time. So that's probably the primary reason why everyone's calling this phenomena gamma rays.
It's a matter of exclusion. You can't have a gamma, because gammas come from nucleus. You can only have X-rays if nucleus is untouched. So that's why I was talking about the electron absorption by nucleus, and you said no.
Well, they're still trying to figure out exactly what's happening there, but at this point, they're pretty much speaking of it more as a kinetic collision rather than as an electron capture. The idea, at least the way I get it, is that the enormous kinetic energy released with the collision of the electron on a nucleus is enough to generate a creation of some other particle, be it a photon of gamma rays or a positron.
Okay, thank you very much, Dr. Roy.
VDH with a question.
Yes, John.
Are there any relationships to this gamma ray emission as related to the sprites that come off some types of lightning discharges?
Problem is that there's so little data that there's nothing that correlates the two together at this point, as far as my understanding. They're just too spotty data points available. You know, they have to go back and study more and more and add up the data that they have. Right now, it's an interesting curiosity because they found both of those type of gamma flashes and the dull ones simultaneously, so it got written up. But otherwise, these findings are very rare, so they probably just need to look a lot more to see if there's any correlation between the two.
So I guess they also don't have any information about what part of the lightning discharge the gamma ray radiation appears from. So it's interesting.
Lightning and thunder, we kind of take it for granted most of the time, but there's still so many questions to be answered. I mean, Dick has mentioned before that lightning does not go straight from, say, a cloud to the ground. It travels in these short lengths, and sometimes it peters out, and sometimes it goes off in a slightly different angle. And we have some nice theories of what's causing these particular branches, but we don't know for sure yet. So there's a lot more research and a lot more study and a lot more secrets to be discovered about lightning. Okay, on to the next. Russia, sometimes described as a gas station with nukes, or what Gangland, Chicago would have looked like if Al Capone had gone into the natural resources business instead of whiskey distilleries. Russia's plan to build a hypersonic weapon system that can travel at more than 20 times the speed of sound and also evade U.S. missile defenses has predictably rattled the world. Last year, Russian President Vladimir Putin boasted that the avant-garde weapon system would be ready by 2019, but some obstacles lie ahead that could impact production, CNBC reported. Specifically, the Kremlin needs to find another source of carbon fiber material to build their avant-garde hypersonic glide vehicles. Russia's current supply of carbon fiber material is unable to withstand the extreme temperatures of hypersonic flight, according to a U.S. intelligence report reviewed by the CNBC. Russia is hunting for an alternative source of carbon fiber, but so far has had no luck. It's expected that they will make no more than 60 of these hypersonic weapons because it's just proving to be too expensive to develop, an anonymous official told CNBC. As it stands, the current plan is to reach initial operational capacity of the avant-garde by 2020, according to Russian news reports. The current goal is to build 12 weapons by 2027, so it will be a long time until Russia is able to reach those 60 weapons. Meanwhile, the U.S. Army plans to field a battery of its own hypersonic missiles by 2023. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Enter exchange.
Yes, Wesley.
There is some mix-up in it. President Putin was announcing few of wonder weapon, which most of that is baloney. So one of them was ultrasonic one, and the other one was nuclear-based propeller. The supersonic one is actually any rocket that is launched up in the sky as high as possible, and then it's sent down with some force of the remaining fuel. On its way down, we're dealing with acceleration in both. That would be the fuel that is left over, and we're talking about a natural forces that pull that bullet down. And by that time, there is enough of room to redirect that to any pinpoint area in half of the hemisphere, and to exit.
Okay, Wes. Well, that's the theory. The problem is that their material scientists can't supply them with material that will survive the heat produced by the speed they plan to run this thing at. So, you know, lots of luck with that idea. Unless they can come up with some material that can survive temperatures that type of acceleration will produce in atmosphere.
But the problem is more deep than that. Not only Russia, nobody can make such a material. We're talking about the temperature that is approximately 10,000 degrees of Celsius. And there is no material known. Even a carbon-based material that could withstand that. Do you agree with that?
Yes, unless you know, some military lab someplace in this country is working on something, and of course doesn't tell me about it. As far as I know, there is no such source. That's their big problem. If this was readily available, say in China, they would just kind of park the truck out in front and load up their truck and make their little missiles. But you're quite correct. I mean, I am sure that someone's going to write an article that graphene is probably the answer, assuming that anyone could figure out how to manufacture more than one square millimeter of graphene. But right now, there is no material that's able to do things that Putin promised he was going to do. Gee, you think maybe he lied?
Critical carbon fiber components cannot survive 10,000 degrees of Celsius.
I agree with you, Wes. This is not a disagreement. I agree with you. It is presently technologically not feasible under the circumstances I am aware of, but keep in mind that I do not have a secret clearance. So someone might be working on something incredible, and they're not going to tell me about it.
I would take it from the perspective of the bodies from space falling down that loses mass like crazy, and from, let's say, 500 kilogram stone, it's little left, even if anything. So we're talking about any material, stone, any material at all. It cannot survive it and to exist.
And I agree with you, Wesley. No naturally occurring material that I'm aware of can possibly cope with this, which is one of the problems. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that there is not a very non-natural metamaterial that somehow is able to kind of get around this, but I am not aware of it, and I'm sure there's a lot of material labs working on all kinds of things, and partially to kind of see if they could do something like this. So presently, no. Lots of luck with Putin. He basically is not going to, that thing isn't going to fly no matter what he does. But he's just kind of pulled it back to say he's only going to do 12 weapons, and he figures the first one I don't know. It's just, I think this is more hyperbolic nonsense than anything else. But I thought it was interesting to show how these promises kind of fade away if you give them enough time.
Okay, let me fantasize for a moment. Let me drop. Supposedly, we have object high up in the sky, and we drop it and we accelerate the speed with whatever fuel we have left. But is cryogenically cooled, and there is the fuel that is there is used to work against the friction of air molecules towards the surface of the material. And let's say we use carbon-based material, would it work? And to experience.
Presently, as far as I can figure, no. Because there's no kind of, you can't use fuel as a lubricant. The whole problem is banging into gas molecules on the way down. So if anything, you would love to kind of push them to the side and generate a vacuum tube for this thing to fall into. Not to pump more stuff out there that it'll probably bang into even more.
If you recall how some medical equipment is built that uses magnetic forces, they have a one big shell with helium in it, and then there is another shell that is isolated inside and has a liquid nitrogen, LN2, inside. If we were to think that instead of vacuum, we have helium inside, then if we drop that thing before the first shell is completely damaged and the second one is still intact, we have quite a big distance already passed by that rocket falling down. Do you agree with what I'm saying?
In theory, you could use the phase change of, you know, gas to a liquid to gas, an endothermic reaction to draw the heat away. I don't think you could do it appreciably to the point where your equipment would survive, though. You might be able to drop it by a degree or two, or maybe even three, but these are ridiculous temperatures we're dealing with.
That time complete.
I agree with that. Now, the second thing is rations. So they have a number of rockets, and they call them Satan, Avant-Garde. I'm trying to find even more names of it. Yes, okay. Satan. So one is a Satan, the second is Avant-Garde, and there is a Sarmat. Let me jump. And it looks like, from words of Mr. Putin, that there is a whole new technology that is launched. But the problem is that if it was true that they have one of the rockets that is powered by nuclear engine, so think about it more like a plane that has unlimited mileage and can fly for years and can cruise around and cannot be put down by any brackets because can avoid it and whatsoever. That's basically the picture of that piece of war weaponry that President Putin is drawing to us. Let me jump. The problem is that when he was presenting that weaponry in his speech to the nation, it was 2 years ago, he used the film, the animation that was made 20 years ago with the very much primitive tools showing how the rocket is cruising around, and at the end there was map of Florida and the about 20 warheads out of that single rocket were hitting Florida, and that what created a lot of criticism to that. But every rocket like that must leave the tray, train of radioactive particles, something behind that will be easy to spot. So if it was that President Putin was doing one single flight of such a weapon, we would have a 20 miles, 50 miles of radioactive cloud that would be behind that rocket and to Xi'an, and nothing was found.
Well, Wesley, once again, I agree with you. Putin basically rattles his saber. The Russian Federation has the same gross national product as the country of Italy. It is not a world power. It has not been a world power until after the Soviet Union fell. It is the mouse that roared. It's a guy with a bunch of nukes that he found, in the basement. And he's waving them around and then threatening with space-age equipment that there's no indication he has the technology to utilize. You need some computer hacking done, you go to Russia. You need to buy a couple thousand tons of bauxite, aluminum and such, you go to Russia. You want state-of-the-art technology, you don't go to Russia.
W2L repeater.
A few words about the actual situation out there. The retiree leaves for $120 per month. The salary of a nurse is approximately $175 to $200 per month. The teacher is approximately $200 per month. The flight attendant, $220 per month. And electrical engineer can go as high as $320 per month. And to exceed.
But if you happen to be the aluminum czar, you can probably make a couple, $5 or $6 billion a month. So I guess it all settles out in that country. I don't know what to tell you. It's a confusing place. I don't understand why we treat it like it's the Soviet Union anymore. It's just, like I said before, if Al Capone had gone into the resource business instead of the moonshine business, it would probably look just the same.
Well, there is a lot of explanation for that situation. Russia is going down for 101 years since the 1918 revolution, 17 revolution and 1918 murdering of the Tsar and his family, his children, and they are going down. They didn't go, they are in feudalism, but very high state of feudalism right now. And there is a corruption at every level, starting from buying eggs in the store, meat in the store, to anything that is at the higher level of it. But Russia has one good thing. At first, is the first country in the world in production of oligarchs. You can look at the internet and you find plenty of them. So, yes, but apart from that, let me jump. It's a cheap gas station for the world. About officially 47% of Russian money comes from sales of oil. The population of Russia diminished. It is being estimated for 143 million people, but actually we could use unfortunate word native. Native Russians are only 82 million. They're losing 1.8 million Russians, native Russians, per year. That's because 40% of Russian population is in retirement age. There is very little of new young Russian out there. Interesting.
Wesley, we're kind of veering into the political net, and I don't like to do that before or after midnight, so we'll kind of call it a day right now. I agree with you entirely. They fixed the game so badly that no one else wants to play the game, and you need people to play the game for it to work. It would be as though in Las Vegas they changed the to a trillion to one that you'd get anything, and then they wonder why no one would go to Las Vegas. So they got a lot of problems. I don't really think they can solve them simply. I think something has to get a lot worse before it gets any better. But, again, that's for the political net. So thanks, Wesley. I appreciate your participation. This is AC2GS, and once again, I just want to remind people, if you have any topics, questions, or answers, or what have you, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com and mailbag@ac2gs.com. And all these things will have links to them at roy.ac2gs.com. And now I shall turn it over to Dick, who will then turn it over to Paul for the space report.
Excuse me, one question for Dick, if you don't mind.
We're a little bit late. I think we should go over to the SpaceNet quest. Is it a real quick question?
Yes, it is. The spherical wavefront comes from a point of source. And we're talking about cylindrical wave. If the wave is emitted from line source, then wavefront are cylindrical. Since the wave expands to fill the cylinder of radius, let's say R, the wavefront crosses the cylindrical area that grows as area. Now my question is, what is point? Could we say that, and what is line? So cylindrical waves are created by a line source. Could we say that dipole that is vertically polarized is point, or it's line? Could we say that ground plane is point or line? And to achieve it.
Was quick.
None of the above. The line source looks like a cylindrical source when you're close to it. I don't care how long the line is. If you're the right distance away from it, it becomes a planar wave, a TEM planar wave, in the real propagating wavefront. TEM is the only kind in a uniform medium. Only up close in the reactive near field of a long linear source do you have something you think is cylindrical. That's not real propagation at any significant distance. We've got to go over to Paul now. We've kept him a little bit too late. WS2N, what's that doing? Over to you, Paul, K2RAW in the Texas.
Very good, Dick. And Roy, this is WS2N for the space portion of the TechNet. And I just want to start off with a couple of the launches, because I usually get a lot of launches during the month of July and August. I just try to cover the more interesting ones, the ones I think are more interesting. I have this one from Chandrayaan, I think it's pronounced Chandrayaan 2, from India. That's going to be launched next week, 7 days from now, July 14th. And it's a lunar mission, the second mission to the moon. They've previously sent an orbiting spacecraft around the moon years ago, and that is another one. It's also going to have an orbiting spacecraft, but it's also going to have a lander, and it's going to have a rover, too, their first attempt at landing on the moon. After landing, they'll release the rover. The Bikram lander will land, and hopefully this solar-operated vehicle will be able to traverse the surface. So I'll be looking forward to see how they do. They're launching it on a GSLV rocket. That's the geosynchronous launch vehicle. That's their big vehicle. They have a polar vehicle, which is a little smaller, and then they have this one, the geosynchronous launch vehicle. And that's the one that they use for launching stuff to the moon or to Mars, for instance. They have a satellite in Mars orbit as we speak today. and they're working on a second one. Another launch that's coming up is the another Soyuz flight. It's going to bring a crew up to the International Space Station. And they're going to be launching on July 20th, which is the anniversary of the Apollo 11 landing on the moon. Well, they're going to be launching a Soyuz vehicle from Russia to the space station with a new crew. There's a crew of three right now out there. That'll make it six. Three more going up on MS-13.